Friends, this is Dr. Beter. Today is October 31, 1980, and this is my audio letter number 59. Earlier this month, millions of baseball fans were preoccupied with the World Series. The World Series is always great fun, with plenty of excitement and suspense right to the end. And even if your team loses, it's not so bad. There's always next year. Now, you and I are caught up in a World Series of a different sort. Ours is a series of battles to determine what sort of world we will leave to our children. And there will be no rematch next year. If we strike out now, the game is over. So we need to keep swinging until we finally hit that home run we need in order to win. My three special topics this month are topic number one, the Iran hostage release plan for war. Topic number two, Senator William Proxmire and Action Step 4. And topic number three, Action Step 5 on a new battlefront. Topic number one, during this month of October 1980, three issues have dominated the news here in the United States. One has been the continuing war between Iraq and Iran. That has been overshadowed in turn by sudden new rumors about a possible release of our hostages in Iran. And the third issue, riding the waves of other events, has been the upcoming election. These three ongoing news stories are all related, and in turn, they all reflect a fierce struggle behind the scenes among three different power groups. One group is that of the satanic Bolsheviks, who now control the United States government. Another group is that of the Rockefeller oil cartel, now under the control of John J. McCloy. And the third power center is in the Soviet Union, whose rulers today are in a battle to the death against the satanic Bolsheviks. The primary actors right now are the Bolsheviks and the McCloy oil group. It is they who have done most of the maneuvering in the Iraq-Iran war, in the hostage release rumors, and in the election buildup. But in all three areas, Russian agents have been joining the fray too. Wherever possible, they are trying to interfere with Bolshevik plans, even if that helps big oil temporarily. For most Americans, the rumors about a possible hostage release have become a central issue in recent days. It seems to have sprung from the Iraq-Iran war and talk of trading spare parts to Iran for the hostages. And the prospects for a hostage release are also being watched for their effect on our national election. And so, after nearly 1 year, the Iran hostages are again on center stage. And now as then, my friends, the real stakes in the Iran hostage issue involve the danger of thermonuclear war. Last month in Audio Letter 58, I explained how the Iraq-Iran war was triggered. It involved a huge bribe to Iraq, engineered by the Rockefeller oil cartel. And it was paid in gold, $8 billion worth of gold. This was part of the very gold which was stolen years ago from the United States Treasury depositories. The goal of big oil is the one I explained last month. They want to finish what they started by their overthrow of the late Shah of Iran. They want to retake control over Iran with its oil riches on new and more profitable terms. And to do that, they want to topple the so-called Khomeini regime one way or another. The war with Iraq is supposed to begin that process. But Iran is not the only arena in which the crumbling Rockefeller cartel is trying to reassert itself. It's happening also right here in the United States. All the old faces from the heyday of Rockefeller power under the Nixon administration are clustered together right now under the Republican banner. The ghost of Nelson Rockefeller is grasping for the White House once again. Meanwhile, the Bolsheviks who have seized control of the United States government have no intention of letting go. And the easiest way for them to retain control is simply to keep the same faces on the scene. And so, the Bolsheviks here are doing everything they can to prevent a change in the White House. Last month, I reported that the Rockefeller Big Oil Group had worked hand in glove with this Bolshevik government in the Iraq-Iran War. But here at home, the two are rivals. Last month, I said that Big Oil was only setting itself up for double-cross by the Bolsheviks. And sure enough, this month, the Bolshevik double-cross began to materialize in the form of a sudden new hostage release plan. By means of this one ploy, the Bolsheviks in the United States government were hoping to pull the rug out from under the Rockefeller Oil Group, both in the Persian Gulf and in the election here. On October 6, the Republican campaign announced the formation of a special advisory group. The group was said to be for the purpose of watching for and planning against a so-called October surprise, quote-unquote. It was feared that something was about to happen to upset the apple cart just before the election. The very next day, October 7, their fears began to be realized. An independent presidential candidate, Barry Commoner, announced that he had received a hostage release proposal from Iran. It was turned over to the State Department, and there began to be flurries of excitement. On October 9, the hostage story warmed up some more. That day, State Department spokesman stated that they were in contact with the hostages. Referring to the top-ranking hostage, Bruce Langen, the spokesman said, quote, "We are in contact on a regular basis," unquote. The next item to build anticipation over the hostages came from Norway. Norway, like Iran, is in the front lines of the Bolshevik planning for a nuclear first strike at Russia. I reported that long ago in Audio Letter 37, and on October 10, a newspaper in Oslo, Norway, helped to move along this latest Bolshevik ploy. The Norwegian newspaper quoted former Iranian Foreign Minister Gutspadeh as saying that Iran should release the hostages immediately. In the United States, the excitement built up another notch. For the next week or so, the Iran hostage release rumors were allowed to simmer for a while. Then on October 17, Iran's Prime Minister Rajai provided the next excuse for heightened rumors. He appeared before the United Nations Security Council, where he bitterly attacked the United States for helping Iraq in the war. But that was downplayed in the news compared to other remarks Rajai made in a news conference a day later. Under pressure of the war with Iraq, Iran seemingly was looking for a way out of the hostage crisis. The rush of rumors turned into a torrent after that, and on Wednesday, October 22, NBC Nightly News carried a sensational report. It was said that there had been a breakthrough, quote-unquote, in the negotiation over the hostages. Supposedly, the Iranian parliament was almost certain to set conditions for the hostage release during debate on Sunday, October 26, and that could be followed by the actual release of the hostages as early as the next day. Up to that point, the Bolshevik planners had everything going their way. By their calculations, the release of hostages on that schedule would have guaranteed re-election of this Bolshevik administration, because the entire week preceding the election would have been filled with news of the hostages. There would have been the drama of the release itself. Then for days, stories of some of the hostages coming home, others going to intermediate stopovers for medical treatment. Stories of reunions, interviews of former hostages and their families, special news reports to rehash it all. And my friends, if it had all gone as planned, there would have been euphoria here on Election Day 1980. Millions of formerly undecided voters would have been caught up in the emotion of the moment, and the Bolsheviks were certain that they would pull the lever marked Jimmy Carter in the voting booth. It did not matter that cynicism would set in later over the timing of the release. By then, the election would have been over, and the deed would have been done. That was the Bolshevik plan of the United States government. But once again, Russian agents are trying to intervene in an effort to unravel these Bolshevik plans. From the very beginning, the hostage situation in Iran has been under Bolshevik control, as I first revealed in Audio Letter 52. But the Bolsheviks do not exercise complete control over Iran, because the Russians have also succeeded in establishing an important level of influence in Iran nearly a year ago. In the present situation, Bolshevik agents in Iran tried to stampede the Iranian parliament into the quick action they wanted. But Russian agents succeeded in at least slowing down the stampede, and the Bolshevik timing was delayed. So now, even if the release of the hostages does take place in one form or another, the effect on our election is less predictable. A last-minute release could even have a backlash effect on voters due to cynicism. And so the election is now up for grabs. It could easily go contrary to Bolshevik wishes. If it does, that will be a setback for the Bolsheviks, mainly in terms of delay. They will be forced to reestablish control over any new administration. That will cost the Bolsheviks a little bit of valuable time in their frenzy to set off Nuclear War I. And that is exactly why the Russians want a change of administration, simply to slow down the Bolsheviks. But I mentioned earlier that the hostage release ploy of the Bolsheviks was set in motion for two purposes. One was to undermine the grab for the White House by the Rockefeller Big Oil Group under the name of Ronald Reagan. That purpose depended strongly on timing, and so has probably been ruined. But the other purpose of a hostage release at this time is still on track. It is part of the latest Bolshevik scenario to lead up to a nuclear first strike against Russia. The first step in this latest war plan was to set off the Iraq-Iran war, as I mentioned last month. The Rockefeller Big Oil Group did this, thinking they were starting the downfall of the Khomeini regime. But the Bolsheviks here used it for another purpose instead. Basically, the Bolshevik United States government is saying to Iran, release the hostages, and we will give you military help against Iraq, which is backed by Big Oil. And to get ready, a sizable amphibious attack force of United States Marines is on the way. The force includes a helicopter carrier, landing craft, and some 1,800 Marines. It passed through the Suez Canal very quietly on October 27, heading for the Persian Gulf. The tactics keep changing, but the strategy is always the same. Lately, our fears have been stoked up over Russian designs on the Middle East and Persian Gulf. First, Russia was given a black eye by its past ties with Iraq when Iraq invaded Iran. Now we are hearing about Russian overtures to Iran by supplying certain war needs. And in the midst of it all is the hostage release ploy. The Bolsheviks here are trying to set the stage for a massive American military return to Iran. If the plan succeeds, it will be as I described it long ago in Audio Letter 37, and I quote, "The American public will demand that it is time to stand up to Russia, and with full public support, American troops and weapons will pour into Iran. From that point onward, the outbreak of Nuclear War I will be all but impossible for the public to follow by way of the so-called news." End of my quotation from Audio Letter 37. The Russians know what is afoot, and they are trying to ruin the plan. In this case, that means trying to spoil the hostage release negotiations altogether. Up to now, Russian agents in Iran have succeeded in spoiling the timing of a hostage release, and they are still at work as I say these words on October 31, hoping to prevent the hostages from being released at this time. If they succeed, it will be the fourth time during 1980 that nuclear war has been averted. Even so, the Bolsheviks who have taken over our government never rest. By the time you hear this, the election will be passed, and the matter of the hostages may have been decided. But the Bolsheviks already have another serious crisis building up in Poland. For 2 years now, the Bolsheviks have been trying to create an explosion in Poland. The first plan was the one for a Pope's Revolution, as it would have been known. I described that plan in detail in Audio Letter 42. But just as in the present hostage release ploy, timing was critical to the Pope's Revolution plan, and the Russians were able to spoil the plan by changing the timing of the Pope's visit to Poland. But now, the Bolsheviks have a new weapon of destruction in Poland. It is the so-called independent trade union movement. It has been given the old Bolshevik name, Solidarity. But its real purpose is not solidarity, but division, turmoil, and revolution. 2 months ago, the new rulers in the Kremlin defused the confrontations then brewing by approving major concessions to the strikers. Now, many of the Polish workers want to take a breather to consolidate their gains. But the Bolsheviks did not create the new labor movement for that purpose. Instead, there are new and bigger demands, spreading agitation, and threats of a new major strike. So now, Poland's borders with Russia, East Germany, and Czechoslovakia are slowly being sealed off. Large concentrations of Russian troops are now poised along the border in Russia and East Germany. The Polish workers, having been used as pawns, may soon lose everything. But those who have used them, the Bolsheviks, may well get everything they want: revolution, strife, and bloodshed. If that happens, my friends, it may be the last straw for the leaders in the Kremlin. Last month, I reported that Russia had begun making feverish preparations to be able to decimate New York City by means of geophysical warfare. I can now report that these preparations also extend, in more limited form, northward into New England. There is a little known but major fault that runs along the East Coast, partly offshore, partly on land. And Russian cobalt bombs for earthquake generation have now been planted in 8 areas along this fault in the northeast. These locations, respectively, are south of Providence, Rhode Island, south of Norwich, Connecticut, several near Hartford, Connecticut, near New Haven, Connecticut, south of Springfield, Massachusetts, and near Northampton and New Bedford, Massachusetts. But it is still New York City that is now subject to the greatest devastation by far. The reason, as I explained last month, is that New York is the headquarters city of the Bolsheviks here in America. Right now, the Bolsheviks are trying to see to it that Russia has her hands full due to revolution in Poland. But if that happens, the Bolsheviks here will also have their hands full. They may well find themselves picking through the smoking rubble of that ruined headquarters city. Because, my friends, at last report, there are now 85 earthquake-producing cobalt bombs buried beneath the waters around New York City. Topic number 2. For several months now, I have been offering you my step-by-step answers to the question, what can I do? I began doing this because more and more of you were asking me to do it. You had started telling me that you were no longer satisfied just to watch and listen as our crises multiply. Instead, the time has come for action, now or never. In Audio Letter 56 last July, I said that what we must do is to wage preventive war. Ours is a war of truth to head off nuclear war. Our strategy is to take away the gold weapon which our enemies within are using against us. And by revealing the truth about the theft of America's gold supplies, the gold weapon will become our very own. This is the only way, my friends, we can seize a weapon big enough to halt our betrayal into national suicide. The first battlefront in our preventive war
is our campaign directed at Senator William Proxmire, and we must continue what we have started along those lines. But up to now, Senator Proxmire has been conspicuous by his failure to take meaningful action. So this month, we are about to open up a second front in our preventive war. It lies totally outside Proxmire's control, yet could also increase the pressure for him to act. I will go into all that in topic number 3, but for now, I want to concentrate on our direct campaign with Senator Proxmire. For more than 2 months now, many of you have been showering Senator Proxmire with letters. As I've suggested, you have demanded that he open up a full public investigation of America's gold reserves. Ultimately, there will have to be a complete physical inventory of our gold, if there is any left. My friends, in any campaign like this, every effort is always made to make you feel isolated. But if you think you are alone in your concern about our missing gold, think again. To give you an example of what I mean, I have an important letter to read to you. It was written to Senator Proxmire early this month on October the 2nd. The writer is a very astute businessman in Proxmire's home state of Wisconsin. What's more, he's a man who knows Proxmire socially. But wait until you hear what he thinks about the situation. He sent a copy of his letter to my dear friend, Mr. Edward Durrell. He gave permission to make it public if desired, and Mr. Durrell provided me with a copy. I will now read it to you. Dear Bill, Mr. Edward Durrell, a close friend of mine, has sent me a copy of his letter to you of September 5, 1980. The crux of the letter asks that you demand an inventory of the nation's gold reserves. I have written to you on this subject myself more than once. The reluctance of the Treasury Department to provide a sensible answer to this basic and simple question appears to indicate that the present real value of the Treasury's gold reserve might represent the ultimate golden fleece. The inventory practices which the Treasury is currently using would not be accepted by any public accounting firm, nor by any corporate management I know of. It is elementary that the nation know what its gold reserve is, and the fact that no action is taken to take a physical inventory, as would be required by generally accepted accounting standards, makes the United States gold reserve an open question around the world. I have personally heard this question raised by financial people in both London and Zurich, and of course many times in the United States. As chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, this is certainly one of your responsibilities. It seems strange that you do not take a determined action on this question, which is so much more important than the many other incidents of waste which you have pursued with vigor. Sincerely, and there follows the signature of the writer. My friends, the letter I've just read to you represents the thinking of more and more highly informed business and financial people. So don't let anyone bluff you into thinking otherwise. Now let me return to your own letter-writing campaign. By now, you should have received at least one reply from Senator Proxmire. Some of you have received 2 replies by now. The first wave of letters to Proxmire in August produced a computerized form letter which I quoted last month. Proxmire began sending that letter to people in late August. In the letter, Proxmire passed the buck to the Treasury itself. Supposedly, he asked the Treasury's Inspector General for a report about a specific missing shipment of gold. This was the mystery shipment of January 20, 1965 from Fort Knox. It was a shipment worth more than $1 billion, $1,000 million at today's prices, and it was admitted in writing 5 years ago by Mrs. Mary Brooks, then director of the United States Mint. Yet it was listed nowhere on the official Treasury listing of shipments from Fort Knox. Now the time has come to ask a new question, my friends, and that is, whatever happened to that promised report by the Treasury Inspector General. After all, you've been writing to Senator Proxmire since mid-August. I hope that you've been keeping a file of all your correspondence to and from Senator Proxmire, because now it's time to write your most important letter yet to Senator Proxmire. And if you can refer back to the date of your first letter, it will increase the impact of this letter. If you have not been keeping a file as I urged you to do, then just do the best you can on this letter. But please do start now to keep a file in a folder or in a manila envelope. As time goes on, this will become more and more important. By the way, if you have not written before but want to write this time, by all means, please do so. Make whatever changes you need to in the model letter I'm about to suggest to fit your own situation. And send your letter to Senator William Proxmire, Proxmire, Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C. Now, here's what I suggest as a starting point for your newest letter to Senator Proxmire. Dear Senator Proxmire, for several months now, I've been writing to you to urge that you open a full public investigation of America's gold supplies. I first wrote you about this urgent matter on date so-and-so. In reply, you promised as a first step to obtain a report about one matter from the Treasury Inspector General. This matter was the missing gold shipment on January 20, 1965 from Fort Knox. I have also written you more recently on this overall subject, but up to now, your replies continue to say that you have requested a report, not that you have received one. So I now ask, have you received the report you said you requested from the Treasury Inspector General over 2 months ago? If so, then I request that I be furnished a copy promptly. But if not, then why not after so long a time? If it takes over 2 months for the Treasury to figure out what happened to $1 billion worth of gold, then something is very wrong. And something is also very wrong if you are content to accept silence about so vital a matter. Once again, I urge you to open up a full public investigation into the condition of America's gold supplies without further delay. And more of my friends and neighbors are beginning to agree. That is the message of the additional signatures at the end of this letter. Unquote. After signing your letter, then get everyone else you can to add their signature below yours. Just signatures of anyone who agrees that your question deserves an answer. Even if only two or three friends will add their signatures below yours, it will help. Every name counts. Use your influence. Before, Proxmire was receiving letters. Now he will begin to see petitions, and more petitions. And my friends, so will other certain very important people. After you have collected all the signatures you can, please make a generous supply of photocopies before mailing the original to Proxmire, because copies of this latest letter to Senator Proxmire will be a weapon you can begin using for other purposes. And we will use them right away as we open up the second front in our preventive war to save America.